Welcome to WisePod. Andalusia Farm, the home of Flannery O'Connor, is pleased to connect you with all manner of business happening here. As Flannery said, you can get to Milledgeville by bus and buzzard. And now, via WisePod. Enjoy.
Well, you see the show all around you. If you weren't here last week, you should know that what you're looking at are rough drafts and rough drafts and rough drafts by very few select examples of rough drafts and rough drafts and rough drafts that were created by the artists who were working with Farrar Straus Giroux to come up with the new covers for O'Connor texts that, these are all out, right?
Reissued.
Yeah, they're reissues of the same editions of the major O'Connor texts. And there are many more of these things, some of which are going to be for sale.
Yes.
You know, one of these days.
Anything that's on the walls you have a hankering for, let's talk.
Yeah, the price is right.
Well, part of the proceeds go to Andalusia and support our preservation mission.
Yes. We should start off by saying that I am not Shannon Skelton.
Nor am I.
Nor is he. Shannon, who was supposed to be here today, had to cancel because of a medical condition. I mean, you know, problems with her pregnancy. She is now scheduled to have C-section, in about 10 days. And, you know, she emailed me. Because I said, hey, what do you tell people about how you're doing? And she said, well, she's in a good amount of pain since she canceled. So more reminders that it was a good idea for her not to plan to read fiction and give a lecture today. And she's really looking forward to the next opportunity to be here and do a presentation. So what we've got to fill in for Shannon is Scott Daniel, and then me. We're both going to give short papers. And I'm going to start by introducing Scott. And the first thing I should tell you is I once had a conversation with a colleague of mine, John Cox, and we were talking about Scott, and we agreed that we just really hate it when our students are smarter than we are. But what can you do? Scott Daniel is a high school English teacher at Warner Robins High School. In addition to teaching AP Art History and AP Language, he has hall duty by the elevator in the old two-story building every morning from 7:15 until 7:40. Wow. He's won some teaching awards at the state and county level, including the Star Teacher Award this year. He earned his master's degree in English at Georgia College and State University. He was there from 2003 to 2008. And during that time, he became a part of the world of O'Connor studies. He's given conference papers all over the South, twice at the O'Connor Conference here, twice at South Central MLA, and three times at the American Literature Symposium in Savannah. He's published a review of Brad Gooch's biography of O'Connor and an analysis of Wise Blood in this magazine called the Flannery O'Connor Review, an article entitled Gender-Bending Innuendo and Mystical Theology in O'Connor's Wise Blood, which won the Sarah Gordon Award. He has spoken at Andalusia before in February of 2009. His main contributions to the ongoing conversation on O'Connor are the detection of a sort of a feminist resistance to traditional masculine theology in O'Connor's image of the divine, and the argument that her fiction forms a certain kind of unified whole, cellular in structure, with its own mythology and its own cosmology. And the title of this paper he's giving today is O'Connor's Anxiety of Influence, or A Good Man Really Is Hard to Find, But I Found One in the Violent Buried Way, and It's Rainbow. Okay, that's all yours.
All right, thank you. My only experience of throwing a book across the room was with an author whom I now revere, Flannery O'Connor. In 2002, the first time I tackled her collected stories, and got to this sentence in The River, describing Harry Bevel Ashfield's death by drowning. He plunged under once, and this time The wading currents caught him like a long, gentle hand and pulled him swiftly forward and down. The long, gentle hand was to me unforgivable. I did not read O'Connor again until, as a veteran teacher working on a graduate degree in English, I was forced to. I took a Flannery O'Connor class in Milledgeville with Dr. Marshall Bruce Gentry, where we read pretty much everything O'Connor wrote, including her second novel, The Violent Bear It Away, from 1960, which I like to think of as the book that threw me across the room. It is when I am reading The Violent Bear It Away that I most viscerally understand T.S. Eliot's comment on O'Connor. She has certainly an uncanny talent of a high order, but my nerves are just not strong enough to take such a disturbance. In large part, this effect is because of the character of Mason Tarwater, a backwoods prophet of the fire and brimstone persuasion. Old Tarwater is a fanatic. It's not precisely his certitude that bothers me. It's his overwhelming authoritativeness. It's that he sounds so certain. It's that he speaks with such conviction. It's terrible. Old Tarwater is authoritative even when he's wrong. O'Connor writes, he proclaimed from the midst of his fury that the world would see the sun burst in blood and fire. And while he raged and waited, it rose every morning, calm and contained in itself, as if not only the world, but the Lord himself had failed to hear the prophet's message. The narrator seems bemused here, but it is a problem that old Tarwater's voice generally does seem more authoritative than that of God, thus obscuring that greater voice, the one that is calm and contained in itself. It is a problem for the other characters who suffer his overwhelming influence, but it is also a problem for the liberally minded reader, even one with a strong religious bent. Don't get me wrong, I love old Tarwater, and I consider him a great achievement. To backwoods prophets, what Don Quixote is to knights errant, what Odysseus is to wanderers, what Faust to scholars, and what Hamlet is to thinkers. He defines the type. He is perhaps the greatest thing about a great novel, one that may still get its due when enough time has passed that it does not feel quite so immediately threatening to our secular modern tendencies. In the final analysis, I think O'Connor's legacy should be more like that of Kafka's, wherein the novels rival the shorter works in importance. The Violent Bear It Away is certainly the best 19th century Russian novel written by a 20th century American novelist. And perhaps the 21st century will be able to recognize that. But part of the problem has been that all the characters, however forceful their expression, were also very off-putting. The old man, the boy, the school teacher, they were so violently themselves, there was no vicarious identification. I couldn't relate. They seemed alien, cut off from my world and its concerns. That changed upon my last few readings, though, as I began to suspect old Tarwater was intended less as an ideal, however grotesque, and more as a real problem. He is not just living faith embodied and contextualized. He is, in his overwhelming authoritativeness, an obstacle to faith. It made sense to me. Such people, the Tarwaters of this world, in their various embodiments and their various contexts, retaining their certitude and their authoritativeness, have been an obstacle to faith in my life. Understanding that gave me new insight into and sympathy for the critically maligned Raber, whom I now consider a successful literary creation and a fine achievement in his own right. He's my point of view character in the story, and understanding him and the subtleties of O'Connor's characterization has given me an even greater appreciation for the novel as a whole. O'Connor seemed to recognize that the novel needed not just any Raber, not just a caricature of secular thought, but a human Raber, a real character. That said, the overwhelming critical consensus has been, from before the book was published, and beginning with the author herself, that she had failed. Yale critic Harold Bloom, gatekeeper of the Western canon, he loves The Violent Bear It Away, but he hates Raber. He calls him the book's aesthetic disaster, and lays down this gauntlet. You cannot listen to Raber's incoherent mix of psychology and sociology without cringing. Challenge accepted. He's right, though. It is cringeworthy in the same way that, say, the Unabomber Manifesto's socioeconomic critique of Western capitalism is cringeworthy. I'm going somewhere with this. So, One critic, at some personal risk, as the Unabomber had not yet been captured, described that work as an incoherent mix of psychology and sociology. He said, "Only someone trapped in the social sciences would talk this way. The arguments here are never very original, and the line of reasoning is often quite convoluted. I'm sure he makes good bombs, but grading him on his intellect, I wouldn't give him more than a C+. That his philosophical worldview is incoherent does not make Raber a bad character or a bad person. It certainly doesn't make him the Unabomber, whatever their stylistic similarities. It may suggest that his puffed up ideology masks anxieties, insecurity, vulnerability, personal shortcomings, you know, human stuff. Besides, I'm not sure old Tarwater's theology is any bit clearer than Raber's psychology." Harold Bloom opines, "O'Connor, hardly a saintly temperament, had neither the compassion nor the patience to understand and know Raber." Maybe, but I think she had the patience and compassion to understand and know herself as an artist. And that's enough of O'Connor in Raber to ground her characterization. Raber suffers, as does O'Connor, as do all artists, according to this theory, from the anxiety of influence. His personality, his ego, are endangered by the existential threat of a larger, louder personality, that of his great uncle, Mason Tarwater. After an early period of adoration and influence, Raber rebels. This rebellion involves misprision, a revisionary reading or a deliberate misreading of the precursor, creating space for the invention of an original self. The mental apparatus through which Raber valiantly sustains his misreading of old Tarwater is a jumbled patchwork of poorly digested psychology and sociology. This happens in families all the time, right? We arm ourselves with the latest self-help books, the newest psychobabble, and diagnose each other for leverage in our relationships. It doesn't have to be plausible ideological combat. It works as family drama. This theory is first presented in a 1973 book called The Anxiety of Influence by the aforementioned Harold Bloom. Bloom interprets creative production in terms of an artist's struggle to overcome the powerful influence of his immediate predecessors. The approach is psychoanalytical, detecting Oedipal struggles, father and son rivalries, in the effort to outdo those authors who inspired us to become authors. All of literary history, then, is mostly family drama. Homer the father, Virgil the son. Virgil the father, Dante the son. Shakespeare the father, Milton the son. Milton the father, Blake the son, and so forth. Bloom writes, "Poetic influence, as I conceive it, is a variety of melancholy, or the anxiety principle. Initial love for the precursor's poetry is transformed rapidly enough into revisionary strife, without which individuation is not possible." O'Connor is able to understand Raber because of the role that the anxiety of influence plays in her work as an artist and as a practical theologian. As an artist, she is in contest with her literary predecessors. For instance, Faulkner, as a Southern author, of whom she wrote, "Nobody wants his mule and wagon stalled on the same track the Dixie Limited is roaring down." The Violent Bear It Away, with its family saga of multiple generations and its gritty viscerality, and more than a few references to the Faulkner short story, Barn Burning, is O'Connor's most Faulknerian work. She admires and challenges Fyodor Dostoevsky as a religious author. Her old Tarwater and Raber are recontextualized revisions of Father Zosimov and Ivan Karamazov, respectively. Bishop is perhaps even a parody of Alyosha Karamazov, a Dostoevsky character type known as the idiot after his second novel. Finally, as a female writer in the Gothic mode, she rivals Emily Bronte, whose Wuthering Heights is an important touchstone for considering young Tarwater and the contest between the Thrushcross Grange of Raber's technological civilization in the city and the Wuthering Heights of Mason Tarwater's primitive faith at Powderhead. Finally, in terms of theology, the novel shows O'Connor's vertical rivalry with religious primitivism, That's fundamentalism of either a Catholic or a Protestant stripe, and her lateral rivalry with religious modernism. While her fiction shows a predilection for the primitive and passionate, her religious thought is engaged with and sensitive to modern ideas. Ultimately, I believe she would sacrifice the latter to save the former, but I also believe she would rather not have to choose. Representing the modern, Raber takes a step forward religiously in the novel, a full step, no less. As does the primitive young Tarwater, a full step, no more. They are the warts and all inheritors of warts and all old Tarwater's mantle. And I think the narrative suggests O'Connor's angst-leavened hope that their paths, as they rise, will, as I'm told they must, converge. Apocalyptic in her predispositions, O'Connor sees in present conflict a future synthesis, a divine happily ever after. For Raber, though, in the beginning, old Tarwater, the man, his uncle, stands before and eclipses old Tarwater, the prophet of God. This impasse is foreshadowed in Raber's first memory of the man. I was out in the yard playing, and all of a sudden, I felt something come between me and the sun. The image suggests the shadow of Tarwater's influence looming over him, but also blocking the light of God. Old Tarwater himself suspects he is an obstacle to Raber's vision, confiding to his great nephew that he is troubled by the thought that he might have helped the nephew on his new course himself. The old man is an obstacle to Raber, not because Raber favors science over religion, but because he favors reason over coercion in family dialogue. Raber seeks to resolve the trauma of his own childhood by reasoning with young Tarwater, a surrogate for the old man. He tells the boy, "You don't even know what makes you do the things you do." He goes on, "I want you to make the choice and not simply be driven by a compulsion you don't understand." Still later, he adds, "I want to put two solutions before you, and what you do is up to you." After many unsuccessful attempts to dominate his nephew the way old Tarwater dominated his nephew and his great nephew, Raber is at last offering him reason as an alternative to domination and influence. In September of 1955, when O'Connor told Betty Hester that you have to be able to dominate the existence you characterize, that is why I write about people who are more or less primitive, the context was a hypothetical mapping out of a tragicomic novel about a character based on the French Marxist intellectual turned Catholic visionary Simone Weil. She writes, "I couldn't dominate a Miss Weil because she is much more intelligent and better than I am." In an earlier letter, she wrote, "What is more comical and terrible than the angular intellectual, proud woman approaching God inch by inch with ground teeth?" I think vestiges of that trope survive in the character of Raber, whom O'Connor confessed to having difficulty dominating. Raber is approaching God deliberately, inch by inch, with ground teeth. That's just not done in O'Connor. His epiphany is imminent in his love for Bishop, a love for the child so outrageous that he would be left shocked, a love he feels he must repress to avoid becoming old Tarwater. O'Connor writes, "He, at the cost of a full life, staved it off." In that, though, he is not that different from us. It is love and not reason we sacrifice so that we can function in the real world. In O'Connor's prayer journal from Iowa, she yearns for the mystical vocation she realized with her typically lucid self-knowledge that she is incapable of attaining. Compared to one of her heroes, French poet, mystic, and holy fool Léon Bloy, who all but wrecks his life in pursuit of the absolute, O'Connor must have felt that she herself was an angular, intellectual, proud woman approaching God inch by inch with ground teeth. Or, like a man, like Raber, walking upright on a narrow line between madness and emptiness. Raber's life may be the ordinary life of faith, its deficiencies rendered as virulent naturalism in the visceral shorthand of O'Connor's startling grotesque. Or possibly, as is true, I think, of many of O'Connor's heroes and heroines, the rabor of the violent barred away is but one difficult moment in the life of someone that, taken as a whole, the author greatly admires. A moment on their arc of development that serves as ugly prologue to a future she can only intimate in the novel's climax. Perhaps she can still look deeper to feel the mad love for the idiot Raber that Raber occasionally feels for his idiot son, a love that prevents him from completing an act of violence. One interesting take on O'Connor's rule of thumb about dominating a character's existence is the implied anxiety that a strong character could resist the author's influence and usurp her authorial control. Raber does this. He advises Tarwater, "You want to avoid extremes. They are for violent people." In a novel that applies the seamlessness of text, how word follows upon word, paragraph upon paragraph, page upon page, the usually distinct elements of character, narrative voice, and constructed reality, Raber intuits the imperative of O'Connor's fictional dream, that running away from God in O'Connor is no different from running toward him. So Raber does neither. If he had killed Bishop, for instance, he might well have been swept up in the current like poor Harry Ashfield at the end of the river. Instead, Raber holds his fear and fury in check, and the effort exhausts him. His overhearing of Bishop's drowning is tantamount to a purgative vision, as though something inside of him were tearing itself free. The living from the dead, the human thought and feeling from the mechanical heart of theory. Upon Bishop's death by drowning, which he witnesses in a vision with technological and mystical components, against the dictates of O'Connor's fictional dream and the conventions of a climax, and contrary to his own expectation, Raber feels nothing. Instead of madness, he gets emptiness. But then, this absence of feeling, the silence of sentiment, as an end to the tenderness of theory cut off from its source, is presage to a new birth. His collapse is the end of old Raber, what he had constructed to resist Tarwater and O'Connor alike, and the beginning of something new. Through the escape hatch of silent attention, he exits O'Connor's fiction until such time, perhaps, as the author herself feels that she can handle a character like Simone Veil or like a future iteration of Raber. As O'Connor herself stated, "If I were to live long enough and develop as an artist to the proper extent."
My paper was a grab bag of fascinating approaches to the violent barred away. A lot of this is borrowed, and I'm going to start by mentioning Shannon Skelton's article in the most recent O'Connor Review, in which she argues for the salvation of Raber. You know, it's a similar thesis to what Scott was talking about, and what Shannon emphasizes is the relationship between Raber and his son, and says it's so powerful that it's going to indicate to the reader Raber's salvation. And then I also found real interesting while I was doing the independent study with Shannon that led to that paper how she responded to other works by O'Connor in which there are parent-child relationships. Shannon is a real true believer. She, you know, buys all of O'Connor's religious principles and is working to see O'Connor's religious principles reflected in the fiction. And Shannon is a fiction writer,
And it was fascinating to me to watch the moments when Shannon thought that O'Connor wasn't working fictionally. And it was about her thinking about parent-child relationships. And so that Shannon would say, for example, that she didn't really buy the end of a good man is hard to find. That she would say, Flannery is tricking us into thinking something religious is going on by pulling a switcheroo and saying the grandmother loves her son at the end of the, you know, loves somebody like a child at the end of the story. And we're supposed to think that somehow that means she has a change of heart on a religious level. And Shannon would say, it's not the same thing. I don't quite buy it. It was a very, it's a very interesting way to look at O'Connor. I'm going to throw at you a number of other approaches to O'Connor. This is more like a list than an organized essay. Let me start with violence. Next week, we've got on the schedule a full paper presentation about violence on O'Connor. And you'll notice that guns are irresistible illustrations, both for the Andalusia postcard for the series and for the cover of The Violent Buried Away. They ended up putting two shotguns on the cover of the new edition of the novel. It'll sell books and it'll, you know, recruit, but there's a case that O'Connor doesn't really like violence and doesn't really approve of shooting people. And I'm not going to go into an argument. I will recommend to you, if you want to read something that makes the full, you know, like theological case, the full philosophical case, that O'Connor is not recommending violence. See Gary M. Siuba's chapter on O'Connor in his award-winning book, Desire, Violence, and Divinity in Modern Southern Fiction. Second point about this is, what if we do take seriously the idea that O'Connor likes shooting people? I would say that leads you to something like this, which I've been talking about way too much to people, the Saints versus Scoundrel video that came out recently from a Catholic cable channel. And if you look closely at the cover, you can see the climax of the video. The saint in the video is Flannery O'Connor, and the scoundrel is the writer Ayn Rand. And Flannery pulls a gun on Ayn Rand and says, I'm going to shoot you, and, you know, I'm going to count to 10, and I'm going to scare the life out of you, and this is going to be good for your soul. And she doesn't shoot Ayn Rand. You know, we don't have the murder of Ayn Rand in the video. But the idea is that Flannery thinks that this strategy really does work. She is channeling some of her violent characters. And I've watched this many times, and I'm going to watch it many more times. And I think, it's fascinating, but I don't think this is Flannery. I don't think she would do that. And I think it's instructive in that way of saying, okay, you know, how do we think Flannery feels about violence? You know, there are going to be some people who are going to buy that book with the shotguns on it because they think it's going to be a ripper and shoot 'em up, and we're going to be rooting for the people with the guns all the way through. And I think there's a limit. Now, just to make matters worse, let me shift to a slightly related topic of apocalypse. I recommend to you also, you did use the word apocalypse in your paper. I recommend to you John Lance Bacon's article about The Violent Buried Away. John Lance Bacon, who taught us to relate O'Connor to horror comics and to Cold War comic books about flying saucers, also wrote an article for the Review back in 2012 called Jesus Hits Like the Atom Bomb, in which he compares The Violent Buried Away to early 20th century end time novels, books like those that most people know in the Left Behind series. And he goes through the whole history of books like that. They've been around for a long time. They were around long before Left Behind came along, with illustrations, you know, from lots of these books. And after he's done the whole survey and drawn all the connections, Lance says, the only significant difference between O'Connor's novel and this tradition she's a part of is that O'Connor doesn't gloat, that she doesn't glory in the destruction of the wicked. And for John Lance, that's Ray Burr in the novel. And she doesn't glory in the destruction of the whole planet that's, you know, foreseen in books like this. I find his article fascinating, even though I want there to be a little bit more difference between The Violent Buried Away and Left Behind than John Lance sees. Okay, Violence and Apocalypse. What else? You can also read this as a book about gender. Notice that I have it on my bulletin board at school. A quote from this novel was made into a poster at the recent Women's March on Washington. You have to quit confusing a madness with a mission. So there's Flannery. Of course, that's the voice of the devil in the novel, but hey, who wants to split hairs? My idea about gender can be overstated simply. Most of the male characters in this book have mental problems because they don't have enough women around. O'Connor endorses the female principle here in, I guess I'll say, three ways. Primarily by tagging the little girl named Lucette Carmody as the most reliable voice of truth in the novel. By turning Tarwater into a woman as she saves him. How else would Tarwater understand his rape but as being treated like a woman? And oh, by the way, Flannery wrote this novel that kind of climaxes with a man being raped several years before James Dickey wrote Deliverance. And third, by having Tarwater avoid manhood. There's a lot of talk. I mean, I was just noticing as I was reviewing it for class in the last couple of weeks, there's a lot of talk all the way through the novel about how Ray Burr is going to make him a man, and the voice of the devil in his head is talking about you have to do this to be a man. And I would argue that Tarwater just decides not to ever be a man. And that Flannery says, hey, good choice, Tarwater. Figure out a way not to go there. I'm beginning to have more understanding for why some people have compared The Violent Buried Away to Huck Finn. How about the topic of race? That's one of the things that we always look for in American Southern literature. And it's not a major theme, I don't suppose, but it is there in the book. In a sense, the hero of this novel is a black man named Buford Munson, who buries old Tarwater and thereby supplies the climactic revelation to Tarwater on which the whole book hinges. Also notice that when Tarwater heads back to the Dark City at the very end, in the final, you know, sentences, he is clearly heading toward a life of ministering to black people. That's who's back there in the Dark City, and the devilish voice in his head has told him earlier in the book, page 433, that if he baptizes an idiot now, next thing you know, he'll be baptizing black people. And I think, you know, Flannery does that for a reason. Okay, and now I'm going to steal, borrow from Elaine Whitaker, who's here today, my boss at Georgia College. We did a paper together a few years ago about The Violent Buried Away. I was so pleased to see how many pages are devoted to The Violent Buried Away in this paper. I'm going to share some of this with you. Elaine knows her medieval literature, and so she was teaching me a lot about things that could be related to O'Connor. You know, O'Connor said she had a 13th century sensibility, and that she really belonged in the 13th century, and I've never really understood what that meant. Well, here's one way to think about it that way. It is possible to map several of O'Connor's plots that involve children onto the medieval idea of the boy bishop, a practice that extended beyond gender. Examining O'Connor's works in relation to the medieval boy bishop tradition makes clear the extent to which O'Connor empowers children. That's kind of the point of this whole train of thought, is that she's always on the side of children and always making them powerful. the medieval church's annual identification of boy and in isolated girl bishops fits into its liturgical calendar of seasons. During the season of reversals, children were allowed almost all privilege except perhaps the ability to celebrate the sacraments. In other words, you pick out some little kid from the choir and you just put them in charge of everything for a while. This is not something we have around anymore, but this is a medieval tradition. Following O'Connor's construction of children and youth from an early draft of Wise Blood through her first story collection provides evidence that O'Connor experiments with and perfects the festal breaches of order allowed to medieval child bishops. The lowly character named Sabbath in Wise Blood was, in many of O'Connor's early drafts, here at Georgia College, a totally sincere prophet figure who experienced valid visions. O'Connor revised Sabbath away from this early conception, but O'Connor may have put some of the early Sabbath into the violent Barrett away as the powerful Lucette Carmody, the little girl who's the child preacher. And it may be that Lucette is powerful because more powerful than Flannery could make Sabbath because Lucette is a child. I would make the case, and I'm not going to today, that a lot of the stories in A Good Man Is Hard to Find have some version of the child bishop. And I think, okay, Flannery was thinking about the violent Barrett away all the time she was writing her early stories. The manuscripts are all going on at the same time. And so it makes sense that we should find in the violent Barrett away, the final working out of this child bishop pattern that she has been playing with. Okay. 4 years lapsed between the first publication of A Good Man and O'Connor's completion of the first draft of The Violent. By its final draft, she has reached a new level of complexity on the empowerment of children. The novel's title comes from a passage in the Gospel of Matthew that was, it happens, subject of one of the surviving sermons delivered by a medieval boy bishop. The Violent Barrett Away contains multiple iterations of what Mikhail Bakhtin calls the characteristic logic of carnival, the peculiar logic of the inside out or the turnabout, of a continual shifting from top to bottom, from front to rear, of numerous parodies and travesties, humiliations, profanations, comic crownings, and uncrownings. Most obvious is, as the novel's focal character, is Francis Marion Tarwater. The agenda for this boy bishop has been carefully prepared for him by his great uncle, Mason Tarwater, whose stories have molded his reality. Young Tarwater feels oppressed by schooling and counters with moments of sass in which he challenges his great uncle's stories. His lineage acts as an oppressive hierarchy too, through Tarwater's knowledge of two complete histories, the history of the world beginning with Adam and the history of the school teacher, Raber. His boy bishopric begins at the death of his great uncle when he becomes drunk as a coot and sets fire to property rather than following the great uncle's explicit instructions for Christian burial. Indulgence in alcohol, a cause for Tarwater's prior punishment by his great uncle, remains to this day a mark of carnival. You know, think Mardi Gras. Tarwater's torching and his travel between urban and rural locations are both features of actual boy bishoprics. Tarwater's bishopric may end when he realizes that his great uncle has already received Christian burial, despite his efforts not to provide it. The reversion to established order manifests itself through the efforts of the traditionally lowest characters, the African-American Buford Munson and the woman at the store who disciplines Tarwater by refusing to sell him a grape soda, symbolically excommunicating him. In the calendar of the church year, all boy bishoprics end, ideally but not always, in progress toward adulthood. The contention that multiple boy bishops exist in the Violent Barrett Away emerges most clearly when Raber takes his son Bishop and Tarwater to the Cherokee Lodge toward the end of the novel. At the lodge's registration desk, Tarwater asserts the authority to name himself. In the church, a bishop is presented for ordination using his full name, and in subsequent references, only his Christian name. During the registration scene at Cherokee Lodge, young Tarwater is intent on correcting Raber's attempt to sign him in as Frank Raber. Ignoring Raber, Tarwater completes his essay on the registration card with his Christian full name and the words, "Not his son." By bringing Tarwater to the lodge, Raber has succeeded in bringing him forth as a boy bishop with a lake set down in front of him and not of his own choosing. Not only does this scene increase the likelihood that Tarwater will act in his capacity as boy bishop, but it also introduces the possibility of agency for the character who bears the maiden name of his mother, Bernice Bishop, as his Christian name. The character named Bishop, though his very young age and mental disability might seem to disqualify him as able to take on the temporary authority of a boy bishop, has already been the subject of some strong critical claims. Karl Martin, for example, has argued that Bishop should be considered the true protagonist of the novel because his religious status is superior to that of even old Mason Tarwater, and because Bishop actually controls the performance of the novel's most significant baptism. Thus, Martin's argument could benefit from the concept of the medieval boy bishop as a way to explain the authority that a boy like Bishop can demonstrate. The key to using the concept of the boy bishop tradition for a new understanding of O'Connor's character named Bishop is probably a scene just before Tarwater simultaneously baptizes and drowns Bishop. The narration at this point is basically reflecting the point of view of Raber, who thinks he's in a battle against Tarwater for mastery of Bishop. Startlingly for Raber, however, Bishop and Tarwater both look somehow ancient as they head toward the lake where the drowning and baptism will occur. Raber is surprised to note that Bishop may be more powerful than Tarwater, more able to transform and renew the world. And here's a long quote. "Each weed that grew out of the gravel looked like a live green nerve. The world might have been shedding its skin. The two boys were in front of him halfway down the dock, walking slowly, Tarwater's hand still resting just under Bishop's hat. But it seemed to Raber that it was Bishop who was doing the leading, that the child had made the capture. He thought with a grim pleasure that sooner or later, Tarwater's confidence in his own judgment would be brought low." Raber comments that if anyone controlled Bishop, it would be himself. Who is himself? What do we mean by himself? Who's really in control here? Is it Raber or is it Bishop? Note also that when Raber hears an unmistakable bellow coming from the lake at the end, he seems to assume that the noise comes from the struggling Bishop as he resists drowning. But there is ambiguity here. Raber also has a moment in which the bellowing appears to come from inside Raber, and the reader is never sure who produces the noise. Perhaps it is Tarwater, who, like Raber, is amazed into feeling like bellowing over the surprising power that little Bishop takes on in this scene. Raber has more in common with Tarwater and Bishop than we usually acknowledge, for he too had a boy bishop phase at 14, in which after having been singled out as special by old Tarwater, he tries to overthrow the old man's authority. The rest of Raber's life may be interpreted as a matter of living out the effects of having been a boy bishop. Another way to apply the boy bishop tradition to The Violent Bear Away is to examine O'Connor's creation of a girl bishop in the person of the child evangelist Lucette Carmody, whose sermon is heard by Raber and Tarwater after Raber has followed Tarwater on a nighttime procession through the city, with Tarwater almost invariably walking in front of his uncle, as Gary Achuba has observed. Leading in a way that requires others to follow is precisely what a medieval boy bishop would do during his reign. At one point, Tarwater enters a storefront church where Lucette, a female of 11 or 12 years, who has been 6 years in ministry, is witnessing. She wears a shortened version of her mother's cape and gown. Raber observes Lucette through a window, hoping to assert control over Tarwater by debunking the occasion. When Raber sees Lucette, however, he quickly qualifies his skepticism, sure that the girl is not a fraud, that Lucette believes sincerely. O'Connor critics have regularly discussed Reber as a version of Dostoevsky's Ivan Karamazov, who wants nothing to do with a god who allows the mistreatment of children. If O'Connor was thinking of Dostoevsky, and she was, Lucette delivers O'Connor's knockout punch to Ivan Karamazov. The girl bishop, empowered by the spotlight in a storefront church, has no use for the pity that Reber is sure she sees in his face when their eyes meet. Lucette preaches about the power of Christ as a child, and then she singles out Reber for personal condemnation. "I see a damned soul before my eye," she says. Lucette overstates her case, I think, but as O'Connor famously said, "To the hard of hearing, you shout." Lucette has to make clear that she does not want Reber's pity. Additional language indicative of reversal occurs sporadically throughout the novel, to the point that one might wonder if O'Connor deliberately added references to the carnivalesque. There are many examples of reversals of things put upside down or backwards, and they generally all empower children. That's the end of that last thought, and I will tell you, I hope that you will reread the Violent Bear It Away sometime and have some fresh ways to look at it. Thank you very much. Scott will now take questions. And Elaine, of course, here. If anybody has a question.
Scott, I'd love to know your general thoughts about what I believe Flannery O'Connor says in the subsequent letters, mm-hmm. that she wishes she could get back to Tarwater in the city, and I believe she says that she feels he'll just be done away with. Mm-hmm.
He'll just be done away with?
That it, the children
of God will finish him off.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yes.
I don't know, it's interesting because Bloom talks about that passage too, and he thinks that Tarwater's taking his arson into the city, right? And so the city is going to be the one that gets it. So I guess, we agree that one of them gets it there. What actually happens to him in the city, I haven't thought a whole lot about. Thematically, you know, I still kind of believe that these two characters are supposed to come together at some point, that there's supposed to be a connection between Reber and Tarwater in the future, completing kind of their relationship outside of the influence of Tarwater. Mm-hmm.
There is a passage in the novel where Reber is changing his mind about Tarwater. He had opinions about Tarwater that he didn't rethink until after everything ended. You know, so it's like it's an announcement early in the novel that Reber thinks things about Tarwater and he's going to change his opinion about them later on. So presumably they lived for a little while. Although I think, you know, Flannery has no trouble with the idea that Tarwater is going to be killed by, you know, the rest of humanity shortly after this novel over. I wouldn't think that would trouble her particularly. You know, death is a promotion and being a murder victim is better than murdering. You know, something along those lines.
Not really a question, I just, the concept, the connection between O'Connor and Dostoevsky, I hadn't really, you know, it's great for me because the two for me are very important, but one thing about Dostoevsky's life, his biography, he was on the firing line, right? Because he was slated for death, right? And they said, okay, let's forget, call that off or something, right? And he was living.
Last second, right?
So that's been to me like, wow, this is his whole, seems like all of his writing came from that. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's a turning point.
I don't know if her illness, you can't really compare it exactly, because there's no, but his death was there constantly with her.
Yeah. I'll bet somebody said that. Lucas is like the firing squad. Sure. Well, and you were just recommending to me
After the firing squad, he spends 4 years in Siberia in prison, and he writes a book about that called House of the Dead. And that's the turning point. He had written a few novels. The first two were pretty good, and then he was kind of struggling. But when he comes back from Siberia, it's like he has a new vision of the world. And everybody is people that he encounters in the Dead House, which he's an upper-class character. It's weird that we're talking about. He's an upper-class, and they are all lower-class, and they have a very strong sour toward him. They want him to be the upper class and to not associate with him and to have their prejudices about the way the upper class is. And I think he takes their personalities and he kind of peoples his novels with them after that. So you read House of the Dead and everything's different after that. So that just supports your idea that, you know, having that death sentence, right? Having your life kind of inverted, right, by conditions kind of beyond your circumstance, that seems to be something that makes a great religious writer.
And then also, Mrs. Skelton, as we always called her, I never read it, but she said she had done something on Ivan Illich. Her writing is compared with the death of Ivan Illich. Do you know that?
One of these days, we're going to get her to come here. Well, there's an exchange in the letters where Flannery says that she's talking to her mother about the idiot. And Regina asks her, what's that book about? And finally says, an idiot. So, you know, she read.
I have an unfair question. I finally got a friend of mine to read some of Flannery O'Connor's short fiction, which is my favorite. And when I got the question I got, which I've had before, man saying, good God, she's just killing everybody off. You know, all these decent people. Now, my question is, what might you say? I mean, what would your response be? I'm standing there with my mouth hanging open, not knowing what to say. I mean, in other words, the violence. And I've talked to a lot of local people here in Milledgeville, and when you bring up Flannery O'Connor, I've heard this over and over. She was a crazy woman, and her stuff is so out there and violent, and good God, you know, all this stuff. I don't know what to say. I mean, what might one say to a person? I always talk about what a great Catholic, and she's religious, and it's gothic, and, you know, you have to really look at the characters, and I don't think she liked self-righteous people. Mm-hmm. One bit.
You could maybe say get over it.
I don't know. I mean, I'm trying to get people to recognize what a magnificent person was here, you know, in their town.
Okay.
So you want to answer that?
I'll do my answer and you can do your answer to it. I taught her in adult Sunday school before, and that was, we did A Good Man Is Hard to Find as our first. And so, you know, I had a hater get in the class and said,
right.
Okay, now explain that to me, right? Make that okay for me. And I kind of resist, even in Sunday school, I resist just, yeah, let's explain it all away. Here's a really complicated theology that explains that this is actually a baptism, you know, and it's sacramental. And the really shocking thing about O'Connor is that these natural things that happen, even death, can be an act of God, right? And if they're an act of God, then it doesn't matter what they are on the natural plane. Mm-hmm. The most important thing about them is that they're an act of God, right? So you shouldn't even be paying attention to the fact that a character gets killed or anything like that. That is God acting through nature, and that's the miracle of it. Okay. So that's one end. I think the middle is you shout at the quote that Bruce just brought up, that it's just a way of getting your attention. Okay. And then I think the other possibility, though, is that O'Connor just likes violence, right? And that it's a reaction to a very constricting expectations of a female writer in the South, and that so she's just lashing out. She wants a lot of her work seems to have the trappings of like pulp fiction detective novels. I mean, you think about the title of the works, like The Violent Buried Away or A Good Man Is Hard to Find, and to me they sound very Dashiell Hammett Like, mm-hmm. And so I think she's really trying to create this different persona in her work just as a way of lashing out against Southern femininity.
You really believe that perhaps that was part of where she was coming from?
I think so, yeah.
Oh, I mean, that's fascinating. I never mm-hmm. even considered that at all. That's incredible.
My influence was just that, you know, we're all, self-righteous, and we're full of defensiveness, and our brains lie to us all the time. And the only way O'Connor thought she could get past that was to threaten you with death. So, you know, it's not good to shoot people, but it's good to get shot or have a few minutes to think about, you know, what's about to come get you. And then your character might improve considerably.
Well, I don't know. Then, you know, you can think about a lot of things. You can start thinking about sex and violence. And, mm-hmm. I mean, this is rude, but, you know, obviously, I mean, I don't know if Flannery was a virgin. It's none of my business. And it's not something that I go to bed pondering, mm-hmm. but obviously her life was greatly limited in terms of she was not married, she didn't have children, mm-hmm. you know, living here, mom, you know, certain barriers. And I don't know if you look at it from a Freudian perspective, sex and violence, perhaps this was an outlet for her that was gratifying in some way, because I know she laughed when she would reread her short fiction.
Yeah.
She would chuckle and laugh.
She loves it.
Yeah. And it is hilarious.
She said she found The Terrible very funny in her books, too.
Very, very yeah. funny.
Yeah. And The Funny Thing's Terrible. Yeah, there it was all the same.
Anyway, I'm sorry. I don't know. I mean, I don't have anybody to talk to about this stuff. You can do. But thank you.
Hey, just for a minute, I need a little help with the concept of being a medievalist.
Mm-hmm.
My son-in-law gave me a book titled Inklings, which was a biographical on C.S. Lewis and his group of male friends that called themselves the Inklings, but they also called themselves medievalists.
Mm-hmm.
It's been suggested that either O'Connor thought of herself in this same way or others think of her that way.
Mm-hmm.
What does that mean exactly? I think I know, but what does it mean?
For her to call herself a medievalist? I mean,
or for Lewis to call himself a medievalist?
I don't know about Lewis. I just think pre-modern science, the church is the center of everything. The Dante's view of the world is, you know, your touchstone. That faith is still intellectually respectable.
Okay, that's what I saw.
And probably some more.
So as
footnotes to that.
Is O'Connor a medievalist? In that sense?
Well, yes, and she was also totally modern. I mean, she has it both ways on everything. She's a paradox because you know, she's also reading 20th century writers, you know, to learn how to be a writer, and then adding on, you know, what she's picking up from her theological reading. But she's not trying to write anything you would call old fashioned. Anytime she's talking about how to write, she'd talk about, you know, the only thing anybody wants to or should want to write is the kind of novel that's never been written yet. You know, that she wanted to be new. And a way to be new is maybe to pick up something like medievalism, which is really gone. It's really fallen out of favor, and stick some of that back into the worldview that goes into the fiction, and then it can seem like something new. I don't know. I've run into a few medievalists who have said to me that the only 20th century writer they can stand to read is Flannery O'Connor. And we had a medievalist at Texas who used to refer to everything I study as the literature of the last 5 minutes, and it wasn't worth paying any attention to. Well, okay, O'Connor's all right. You know, she would say. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, as I was listening to the exposition here today, I thought I could almost see an implied dialogue between you to Scott about Flannery O'Connor as an artist, her development as an individual, beginning as a student, finding influences among other writers, and ultimately achieving independence from that, learning and becoming herself a full-fledged writer, and speaking and developing her own voice and position. And we want to ask the same question of her characters. Do they ever achieve independence from the background in which they developed and had their influences? And did they ever go beyond that and achieve their own voice and location somewhere in the spectrum of development? I'm wondering how you might feel about that.
Yes, totally.
I thought I found that in what you were saying.
I think she fought with all of her inspirations. She fought with all of her mentors. And her characters typically take the novel or the story away from the narrator. Hmm. And take it away from the author, even. And I think she always lets the underling, well, maybe not always win, but at least put up a good fight. How would you answer
that? I think, well, on the cutting room floor from this essay is the passage where I talk about the way in which characters seem to influence the narrative voice of the text. For example, the stranger, the character, at one point he's a voice in young Tarwater's head, but before that he is an idea that old Tarwater implants in his head. He says, you know, watch out, but don't take up with strangers, right, because the devil will use them, and blah, blah. And so the character goes from being something that old Tarwater said to being a voice in the head to being an actual character in the text. And so the characters can really literally take control of the text. They can fight it free. And so I think, like that quotation from the O'Connor letter that I used about dominating her character's existence, you know, it's not so much that she's just dominating them, but she's aware of that struggle, and she's trying, that's part of the dynamic that's to her is what makes interesting fiction, is that the characters are kind of fighting the author and they're trying to get control. Now, I also think that at a certain point the story ends because the character has gotten to a level of development and that's the closure in the story, and they're going to go on. They're usually going to be much better now that the story's over, kind of. It's they've escaped the trial that O'Connor created for them, and they will be good people now.
A well-created character has its own imperatives.
Yeah. And so, like, for me, Raber, he's done at that point, and he's able to go off. Now he can live his life because he learned whatever O'Connor wanted him to learn in the text, or he had the experience, and so then he's free at that point.
When Flannery says that line about she has to be able to dominate her characters, that always sounds to me like a parent saying, I have to make sure I continue to dominate my children. And we know that doesn't work. I think she knows. And the more bossy a parent is, the more you can count on it, that the child's going to rise up and pick a fight with the parent. And so that's, you know, Flannery is playing Flannery Regina with her characters too. I mean, I think there's a parallel there. You know, that what Regina did to Flannery, Flannery did to her characters, and it all worked out fine in the long run.
Are there any more questions? I should let you know that we have refreshments afterwards. You can mix and mingle with our speakers and continue the conversation. But thank you so much. Just a little shameless self-promotion.
Yes.
Next Sunday we'll have Rhonda Armstrong speaking about violence. And then
she'll probably say it's wonderful.
The last Sunday in February we'll have Candace Dyer from North Georgia with a moonshiner talking about moonshine and moonshine imagery in the novel, and then we'll have some moonshine. And if y'all aren't getting our direct mail, please sign up at the front. You'll get gorgeous postcards with images like these.
Excuse me, what about the review? Is the public available?
Yes, you can buy them. Oh,
yeah.
Thank you for
them all on the shelf, right?
In our
there.
Bookshop, we have them for sale.
Okay, thanks.
So thanks again, and there's reception outside, and we're open till 5 today.
Go take
so
a phone call in the back
door. We're going to enjoy the property. My name is Elaine.
That all worked quite well. Just going to put that thing under pretty much as well.
I've got
nice
one more.